This edition of Culture was first broadcast on the 16th of April, 2012. Hello and welcome to the 27th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. This week we saw and swirl on the cultural updrafts of the week, unaided but unshackled by thematic skein running through the show. Instead, we go where our nose takes us, alighting on a glorious, exclusive live session from the Wave Pictures. Wild hair tumbling from the centre of your skull like spaghetti. I knew then that you'd never forget me. I knew then that you'd never forget me. Nice sounds, eh? We'll wheel our way to Cairo soon, too, for the Downtown Arts Festival, to see what the hell happens to art and artists after a revolution, or at least a very bumpy spring.
Of course, as a long-term goal, we would like to have this festival every year. I think it's important that Cairo, Egypt and Cairo in particular, takes back its culture place in the region.
And we investigate the Japanese phenomenon of hikikomori, a heightened form of shutting yourself up indoors to you and I. Australian artist Eugenia Lim has made a show all about it.
It's a very mysterious phenomenon. Mainly young people will shut themselves away in their bedrooms for like over 6 months or so at a time, with extreme cases being like decades. Basically a very sort of teched up version of being a hermit.
Plus an opening night in Dallas and a 1 minute of sound from one arrondissement or another in Paris. That's here on Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. First of all, some live music from a lively band from Leicestershire. The Wave Pictures came in and performed a Midori House session last week. This, from their new album Long Black Cars, is called Seagulls.
I see seagulls picking at the bones of a cat beneath the narrow brim of my Cary Grant hat, where you threw it to the beach from the balcony of my hotel room. The uniform that you and your friends wore embarrassed me more than anything I'd ever seen before. You got a lot of nerve to come round here like this. Crosses the sun, throws a shadow over everything. You pick up an ashtray and throw it across my hotel room. The uniform that you and your friends wore embarrassed me more than anything I'd ever seen before. You got a lot of nerve to come round here like this. To everything that is happening in here, you tip papers out of drawers into piles on the floor of my hotel room. I could never understand how a change of clothes could change a man. You've got a lot of nerve to talk to me like that. You've got a lot of nerve.
Got a lot of nerve. That was the Wave Pitchers singing Seagulls, and we'll hear a little more from them later in the show. Before that, and the rest, we're going to speak to someone who's been getting square eyes so we don't have to, and even going to the south of France so we don't have to. That's less fortunate, I suppose. Lisa Campbell is the editor of Broadcast, the TV industry weekly, and she was in Cannes last week to seek out the hottest new entertainment formats and the countries that are pushing for a higher step on global TV winners' podium. And I spoke to her in the studio earlier today. I wanted to kick off by asking you, I guess, inevitably about hot formats, or maybe before we talk about hot formats, about trends, sort of an overall, what was the sort of overall mood in Cannes at MIP this year?
Well, as far as the content was concerned, there was a real trend towards positivity within television. It seemed to be all about altruism rather than cruelty, which we've seen from a lot of entertainment formats, particularly whether it's celebrities chomping on kangaroos' bits in the jungle or eating bugs or whatever, to, you know, poking fun at the talent show wannabes who really can't sing and think they can. So that seems to be taking a backseat for programmes where the community are being involved in people's problems. And there were quite a few examples of this. Israel is quite an interesting territory at the moment. There's lots of interesting stuff coming out there.
It's a hot sort of format producer, isn't it, Israel? Surprisingly huge amount of TV, I guess, and formats are written in Israel, aren't they?
Yeah, and I mean, drama's actually been quite interesting as well. You know, the Homeland, which is a big hit on Channel 4 at the moment in the UK and in the US, it has sort of come from there. But also on the format side, Keshet is the production company, and it's called Dear Neighbours, Help Our Daughter Find Love. And this is where parents from small towns and villages get together and try and find true love for their city-dwelling daughters who are a bit lonely. So they return home and the neighbours have sort of got together and got some men for them.
So it's like a blind date with a social conscience set in the Middle East.
Yeah, but the girl doesn't know this is going on, and she goes on a date, which is filmed, and then the neighbours watch this on their TVs and vote for who they think is the best match. So sounds utterly terrifying, but, you know, the heart's in the right place,
so
I suppose.
So a bit of Jewish mother syndrome in there as well.
Yeah. So some of these, you know, are quite sort of light and fluffy, but there's some more serious formats in this sort of vein as well.
And we're still in the realm of kind TV. Not this is anti Britain's Got Talent and laughing at people who are sort of a bit kind of caring the community.
Yes.
We're still on a kind TV riff.
We are. Okay. Yes. Yeah. I mean, you know, obviously this kind of change your life TV has been around for some time. You know, things like Undercover Boss and Secret Millionaire, you know, they've been huge hits in America and Europe. I think the difference is that it's been presenter-led, or, you know, had big name talent heading that up. This time it's about people power. And so I think it's quite interesting. It's perhaps come off the back of social media and the fact that, you know, as viewers, we can sit at home and play a much bigger role in the world, in TV, in decision making, in campaigns. So I think TV is trying to tap into that. And in fact, social media was another big trend that came out of the market. I think there's a real panic among some broadcasters, to be honest, about, you know, what are we doing in this area? Are we really capitalising on this as we should? And there's really widespread agreement that, well, they're not. What they tend to be doing is just putting a hashtag around a show. So if you're watching, then you do the hashtag and, you know, you get all the inane comments.
Exactly.
Really. Yeah.
Is it an idea that broadcasters and format writers then need to incorporate social media into their shows somehow? Is this about sort of platforms as much as anything else?
It is, yeah. So you know, it's about what are the best ways to incorporate that. And, you know, some of the research showed that Twitter is best used when it's about live TV and it's the sort of instant reaction, whereas Facebook is used much more for scripted programming and people can really get, you know, delve deeply into the characters of a drama and discuss that with their friends. So, you know, it's about how people are really tapping into that. And there are very few examples of it. And I think that was one of the kind of key messages which was coming out was, come on, everyone, get on with this because you're really missing a trick. You know, and I think where it has been successful, I think the States tend to lead the way more than Europe, is where they're tapping into these kind of super fans and super users and super viewers, as they call them. So they used to be the kind of the culty people who would just kind of, you know, watch box set after box set, whereas now they're going online and they're building shows around them and their conversations. So something like The Walking Dead, which, you know, again, is a really big show in the States. They've created something called The Talking Dead, which then airs after the show. And that was, you know, came off the back of the social media buzz around it. And what's interesting is that, you know, by series four or five of these shows, viewer numbers will be dipping, but they're actually increasing because you're bringing new people into the show who are, like, you know, attracted by all this buzz and are then sort of joining the party. Another interesting trend is, you know, drama continues to be huge. The big budget, glossy productions, they now absolutely have to be international co-productions. There's just no way you can afford these things otherwise. So, you know, it's fascinating on a number of levels, in that you are getting the so much more quality, you know, beautifully produced programming from that. You know, the question is sometimes, what does that mean for the creativity? You know, you've got so many people wanting a piece
to
of
be,
the pie.
Yeah, it has to be one man's kind of fish, another man's poison. It can't be that thing, I suppose. It has to suit, has to tick more boxes across the world.
Yeah,
is that right?
Yeah. And, yeah. And so, I mean, something like, you know, those positive and negative examples, really, but Zen was a detective drama, which was a Italian and British co-production. So trying to cater to British and Italian sensibilities actually failed quite miserably. So that,
I think
that
they starred Rufus Sewell, didn't they? Actually, Rufus Sewell, who could be British, who could be Italian.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. But it's still, you know, it was flawed, and I don't think it worked for either audience. Something like Titanic, the Julian Fellowes penned drama, you know, coming off the back of Downton Abbey, all eyes have been on that show. Mm. It pre-sold to 86 countries. So, you know, clearly massive interest in this. Had 10 international co-producers, so huge numbers of people involved. It sold to 95 territories. And, you know, interesting, it's not actually doing brilliantly in the UK.
No, it's, I don't know how many people are watching it. It certainly hasn't been very well received critically, but maybe that doesn't make any difference.
Well, whether it's a success in the UK or not is kind of by the by in some ways. I mean, yes, it started off with about 6.5 million viewers, and that's sunk to 3 million or something now. So,
did you just do a Titanic pun?
I did.
You sort of made a face.
Yeah,
I got. I wanted to ask you, Lisa. Actually, I wanted to ask you a bit about what the experience of MIP is like. Talking about these formats, I mean, how do you watch those at this show? Are you literally given a bag of DVDs? Do you sit down in a sort of in a cinema situation and watch these programs? Or do you kind of get quick glimpses of stuff? I mean, how do you actually see what's going on at MIP?
Well, you see, you think Cannes is all very glamorous, and in actual fact, it isn't particularly. I mean, it's a huge exhibition hall at the Palais, and there are 1,500 exhibitors. So it's pretty overwhelming when you first step in there. And there are just stands after stand with, you know, showcasing all kinds of tat and as well as quality stuff. I mean, there is a lot of lowest common denominator stuff on show there. But people just, you know, they have their show catalogues, they have little booths where you can watch things. There don't tend to be the big screenings.
It's quite an old-fashioned sort of trade fair, isn't it, in many respects.
Yeah.
You feel that it's sort of, yeah, it's increasingly, it's obviously about a very high-tech industry, I suppose, and an international industry, and there's all these sort of social media applications that people are trying to learn about, and there's a lot of money involved in it. But at the end of the day, you could almost be selling, you know, it could be like a medical trade fair or a pets wear trade fair. It's
absolutely
a strange thing
of
people are selling things out of booths,
yeah,
isn't it?
There's just nothing particularly glamorous about it. Although, well, I say that there are parties in the evenings. You know, people are really trying to grab the attention of journalists and of international buyers. For example, Cineflix Studios, which is a Canadian company, had a fantastic dinner at a Michelin star restaurant, and we were all sort of taken up into the hills of grass and had fantastic, you know, mousse d'asperge and whatever else. And it was really lovely. And they've got this big show, Copper, which they're trying to sell. So they invited, you know, the buyers from the German channels, Swedish, you know, all over the world, people were there being wined and dined and convinced, you know, this is the best show and you really need to buy this. And in fact, it looks quite good. So,
and what is Copper? Is that about a policeman, or is it taking each of the periodic elements one by one and making a show about all of them?
Yeah, that sounds like a great show.
Hooray! We'll play the song in after this. Yeah.
This is set in 1860s New York, and it stars Tom Weston Jones, who plays this very rugged Irish character with amazing cheekbones, I have to say, who was there to promote the event as well. So you do get some celebrities in town. Incidentally, it's all about the gangs of New York, which is like the Scorsese film. Uh-huh. I know you're immediately thinking a TV rip-off of that, but in actual fact, it's much more a sort of gritty historical drama. It's very sort of down and dirty, and, you know, every bodily fluid imaginable is featured in this programme. A lot of it is about contrasting worlds, and in fact, that was another theme of, you know, quite a few of the dramas, whether it's inspired by Downton Abbey and Upstairs, Downstairs and all of those things, you know, the contrasting worlds between the, you know, the wealthy industrialist in this instance and then the growing African-American community and you know, that sort of collision. But he plays this cop, and he's investigating the death of his daughter and or his wife going missing, and it does look quite good.
When I was at MIP 2 or 3 years ago, I think Korea and Taiwan both made a big splash, and there were lots of a couple of hot formats, I think, and some sort of pop stars and big actors from Taiwan turned up. Whose turn was it this year? There's always a sort of big country that makes some news, isn't there?
Yeah, well, China was making quite a big noise there, which is unusual. They, you know, would not normally attend this. They're trying to become a much bigger player in documentaries. CCTV, the state broadcaster, is trying to showcase Chinese culture to the world. And so, you know, there were some of their documentaries and formats on show there, but they're equally interested in getting more documentaries into the country. I think they accept that there is a bit of a quality gap between what they're producing internally. So they want to raise their standards and incorporate some of that. So, it was quite fascinating.
See, the first thing they need to do is to call themselves something else. I'm always terrified of CCTV. Do you know what I mean?
I know. Awful. It is slightly off-putting.
Presumably that's a market that every, you know, the Americans, the Israelis, the British and every other sort of territory across the world and broadcaster and format writer wants to fill the airways of China. Presumably that is the big kind of the great last hope, isn't it, for all TV format writers?
Yeah, well, and people really want to do business in China. So there's a lot more production companies tying up with Chinese companies out there. And if you get a commission from the state broadcaster, then clearly it's going to millions and millions and millions, hundreds of millions of people. Of course, there's the cultural barriers are still quite high at the moment, but it's absolutely one of the emerging markets, as is Brazil and Turkey, where we're really talked about. You know, if you want to sell your format, then really you need to be doing business there.
That was Lisa Campbell, editor of Broadcast magazine. We're going to Cairo for art's sake next. This is Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. In Cairo, the biggest contemporary arts festival in living memory has just taken over the streets made famous by the revolution. The range of arts and venues on offer is unprecedented in Cairo for one festival, and performers have come from across North Africa, the Middle East and Europe. Claire Reid sent this report from the Downtown Contemporary Arts Festival.
Demonstrations continue to be an almost weekly phenomenon in Tahrir Square, and the streets around it still bear the scars of revolution. Blockades, barbed wire and broken windows are common sights. But just around the corner, a new festival is seeking to change that. Alternative theatre in venues at the heart of the revolution, along with new music, film, dance and art, are all part of the Downtown Contemporary Arts Festival, nicknamed DCAF. And performers have taken to the streets too. Artistic director and performing arts curator Ahmed Alatar wants audiences to engage with the city and with the arts in new ways. He says the use of shared areas is a new idea in the Egyptian capital.
Public space in Cairo and Egypt is an unknown notion. I mean, there's no such thing as public space. We don't have places where people can just sit down and, you know, enjoy the city or just enjoy being in that public space. And after the revolution, I think people opened up to the notion of public space, just by the fact that everyone went to Tahrir Square for many nights and slept there and, you know, ate there and talked and argued and so on, even fought there, the public space came back on the scene. And what we try to do with the Urban Divisions program, for example, is to give another dimension to the public space. It's also a space of creativity, a space of calm, in the sense that you can stop for half an hour, watch a few small pieces, go your way, and your intake of the space itself becomes very different.
What do you think that the festival can do for contemporary art in Egypt?
Well, many things. I mean, the festival, first of all, for me as an artist, one of the things that formed my style was the fact that I was abroad and I watched a lot of theatre. That, for me, was equally important as my education, which was theatre education, and also as my practice. And that's something that's lacking in the art field, that we don't see that much in Cairo, in Egypt. So I think that's very important for the development of the art scene and artistic expression. Also the audience. I mean, the audience needs to also get to see these new forms of expressions, get used to them so they don't feel estranged or that distance is reduced. And of course, as a long-term goal, we would like to have this festival every year. I think it's important that Cairo, Egypt and Cairo in particular, takes back its culture place in the region. I think this festival can bring it back to at the same level as Homeworks in Beirut, Dubai Art Fair, or the Marrakesh Film Festival.
Dub and electronica feature strongly in the music programme, alongside jazz, electro and punk. But what unites all the performances is the influence of folk traditions on modern practices. The curator of the music programme, Mahmoud Rafat, says Egyptian music has its own style.
The music scene is very big and it's very wide here. There is a sound. The musicians here, they have their own sound and there is own character in it. And this is developing by the time.
Have you seen any different developments since the revolution?
This has been going on before the revolution anyway. So the revolution did not like make a, like it's a switch and then everybody changed. No, everybody went on and on. There was a drive, of course, yani, in making the things. Of course, it was inspiring for some people and others, they were very sensitive about the subject. But it's inspiring in the very end. But this movement has been going on anyway and it's a revolution on its own.
The visual arts section of the festival is an exhibition of artworks that have been censored or restricted for some reason in the past. It's an empty warehouse with stories representing the missing pieces of art. Its aim is to highlight the difficulties faced by artists in getting their work shown, be it through censorship, misinterpretation or mishandling. Curator Mia Yankovic says the exhibition and the festival as a whole are about pushing expectations.
We're not interested in producing a festival that is simply produced in a hurry, lots of names for no real reason, not much thought put into it, everyone claps and goes home. You know, this kind of highly celebratory way of working. We are all people who are interested in, yeah, criticality and pushing things and perhaps giving people not just what they expect, but actually pushing their expectations through what we do.
How has the audience reaction been?
I think good so far, which surprises me a great deal, because I think this is a very hard exhibition to swallow. I think it's very hard to tell people, yeah, you're going to come to a huge space and you're not going to see any art. That's quite an arrogant thing to do. And I wanted to do it because, I mean, all of these things have happened. All of these things have meant that people could not see the work that we all wanted them to see. It's also a way of highlighting that things are not just, okay, sometimes things are just mistakes. In other cases, you can maybe start to say, okay, let's take this gathering of problems and figure out what's going on.
With Egypt in a state of political reform and uncertainty, the festival is embracing the opportunity to highlight cultural transition and bring contemporary practices to a broader audience. After a new president is chosen over the next 2 months, it's impossible to say where Egypt may be heading, but plans are already being made for next year's edition of DECAF. For Monocle in Cairo, I'm Claire Reid.
Yeah, thanks Claire Reid for that dispatch from Cairo's Downtown Festival. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. We're back with a Japan-inspired show from Melbourne after this.
The Globalist bids goodnight to America, good morning to Europe, and good afternoon to Asia with 2 hours of analysis, paper reviews, and a run through the topical stories shaping the world wherever you are.
The issue of reform and, again, how society forms itself post this crisis is playing a leading role.
Tune in every weekday at 6 a.m. London time.
Welcome back to The Culture Show. Now, Monocle, from its very first front cover 5 years ago to some of its favourite staff members, has been well into Japan. The culture, the creativity, the quirks too. And across Japan, millions of people are locked in their bedrooms, sort of social hermits who only interact with the outside world through the internet. This phenomenon and its tribe are called the Hikikomori. It literally means pulling inward or being confined. Some stay there for months, some for years. One Melbourne artist decided to explore this by placing herself right in the middle of it. She built a bedroom in the middle of a busy gallery and lived there on display for a week, being fed by the kindness of strangers and only interacting with the outside world through her blog. Melbourne contributor Irene Scott caught up with Eugenia Lim at the end of her week-long isolation.
It's a very mysterious phenomenon because I guess it's very hidden. So people, mainly young people, will shut themselves away in their bedrooms for like over 6 months or so at a time, with extreme cases being like decades. Basically a very sort of teched up version of being a hermit, I guess, you know, sort of retreating into the bedroom and playing video games. It's anywhere between like 1 million and 3 million at this point. Like I've been sort of tracking it, and I think the New York Times had an article in 2004, which said there was 1.3 million, and now people are saying that's just in Tokyo alone.
So why do they do it? Is it because there's been some sort of social incident that has made them do it, or is it just because they've decided they don't interact well with society?
It's a bit of both, but it usually stems from some form of trauma. So a lot of it comes from bullying at school or like bullying from family members or whatever. I have spoken to a couple of girls who I guess are women now who've moved over here from Japan. And for them, I mean, it sounds like a very individual kind of phenomenon. For each person, the reasons are quite different. But for these guys, yeah, it was the pressure of the family that sort of, you know, triggered it off. And then, you know, they started not going to school. And I guess it was that idea of sort of protecting themselves from society, but also they kind of felt like they weren't good enough or something. And I just found that really fascinating. And I guess with my work, I'm really interested in looking at like the unseen or the quite hard to visualize, I guess.
The thing I find interesting about it as well is that they are shutting themselves off from society, but they're still interacting with society through the internet.
Yeah, it's really true. There is this kind of sense of community and I think pretty rich like virtual life going on. Their bedrooms are sort of like a sanctuary where they fill it with, you know, anime or manga or whatever and go online and spend hours talking to other people possibly in similar situations. So you're right, like there's still like a social connection. It just isn't a physical one. Mm.
So tell me about your piece.
I've been making work on this topic for a couple of years and it seemed like a natural progression to try and experience it for myself. So my idea from the outset was to build a kind of, I guess, a sort of stripped back idea of what a bedroom might be like. I inhabited for a week, completely shut off from the outside world. I depended on people for my food and water, and I couldn't speak to anyone and no one could enter or leave the room during that week. So there was, I guess, physical isolation, but complete kind of online immersion for the week. There was a website that had a chat interface, so I'd spend, you know, maybe 8 to 10 hours or something online on and off chatting and I guess sort of track how I was feeling over that week. So
basically you'd walk into West Space Gallery and there'd be other exhibitions of, you know, whatever happened to be there at the time.
Yep.
But right up the back of the gallery is this makeshift Japanese teenager's bedroom.
I've been calling it like a pink Plato's cave because it was pretty stripped back. Like if you look at photos of the actual bedrooms, they're full of, you know, any mum's nightmare, like heaps of layers and layers of stuff. And you could view the show, but only through a little peephole. So when you come to the space, there's this sense of like, you know, kind of looking through or peeking through to something that you can't quite touch. And I guess I sort of wanted it to be a bit of a complex process for the viewer. The actual real interaction happened through the website.
And what was that interaction like online? Did you find a lot of people got into the idea of seeing the actual artwork in the gallery and then going, oh, cool, I can actually interact with this woman if I go home and log on?
Yeah, there was, I guess, quite a number of responses, and some were from people who were not in the country and kind of just found it, you know, through the internet. And then others who, yeah, had visited the gallery and were kind of intrigued. And I guess, you know, that element of not being able to talk in person carried over to them wanting to talk online. And then through to the other way, people finding the project online and then going in person to visit the gallery space, which was cool. Like I really wanted for all those avenues to be there.
Yeah. When you've spoken to people that were able to look through the little peephole and see you in your room, what kind of a reaction did they have? It's a little bit depressing, the concept of hikikomori. Mm. Did they feel that when they watched you?
Some of them would stay and kind of sit outside the door as well. It was, I guess, in a weird way, quite peaceful. Yeah, I think people are kind of shocked about the actual syndrome. A lot of the conversation with people was, yeah, you know, well, yeah, I use the internet every day and actually it's not such a stretch for me to imagine. Yeah, I guess I want people to consider that because I feel like it does impact you physically and psychologically. It definitely did for that week anyway for me.
So the project's now in kind of a phase two, I guess. You're not in the bedroom anymore. What is it now?
It's an installation at the moment. So people can go in and sort of walk around this room that they might have been seeing online. And then the website and the online component will kind of be there as an archive. And there's a project blog as well, which is linked off there. And I'm still posting a lot of stuff.
How did you feel that moment where you saw the countdown of the clock and you knew that you'd been in there for the full week and you were allowed to open the door and release yourself from the bedroom?
Yeah, it was very strange because it was such a sanctuary. And I was completely on my own. And then suddenly there's 20 people there and there's champagne and it's kind of crazy. So, yeah, it was a bit of a shift in mindset.
You said that you want to try and do it again maybe in other galleries around the world. Mm. What do you think you'd do differently?
Maybe not in a gallery space. I'm really quite taken with the idea of it happening maybe in a shopfront or somewhere, like in a city, because I like the idea that it goes beyond maybe just an art crowd. I'm really keen for everyone to kind of access it because everyone uses the internet these days. So why not kind of put it right sort of smack bang in foot traffic? It's playing on that fine line of being exhibitionist because it's obviously broadcasting online 24/7. I'd probably still do a little bit of a peephole because it's kind of about layering and making it difficult for people to see in a way.
That was Australian artist Eugenia Lim talking to Irene Scott about hikikomori. Teched up hermits, it's like being locked in Studio One with the aircon off. Still to come in part two of Culture on Monocle 24, time to dust off your Stetson for a Dallas art opening, a minute of sound from Paris, and more music and a huddle with our Midori House session band, The Wave Pitchers. Actually, why not now? Here they are with Between My Ear and the Cradle.
It was close to 11 when I took my shoes off and slept with sand in my mouth. Dreamt of smiles that I didn't like, and eyes that refused to reflect any light, and tight-lipped conversations in shadows at the sides of buildings, under telephone wires with birds strung along them in a giant silence. Between my ear and the cradle, between my ear and the cradle, between my ear and the cradle. It was close to noon when I put my shoes on and walked out to the high street. Under telephone wires with birds strung along them in a giant silence between my ears. Between my ear and the cradle, between my ear and the cradle.
Wave Pictures performing live for us at Amadori House session last week. After the show, Culture's super producer Katie Bilboa got all hikikimori on them and locked them in a room for a chat. Here she is talking to Dave, Franek and Johnny from the Wave Pictures.
You guys have been together in some form or other since about 1998, haven't you?
Yeah.
So that's quite a long time. I mean, just for those of our listeners that aren't so familiar with you and your music, fill us in on the history of the group and how you got started.
Well, I met Franek Rosicki at my fourth birthday party. He came along and we were chatting and we said we should form a rock and roll band. And 12 years later, we had our first rehearsal and we were called Blind Summit. And we used to cover Mudhoney songs and grunge, and we were noisy, and we sort of slowly morphed into the Wave Pictures, which was just me and Franek with a bunch of different drummers. And we recorded a lot of songs that we still play, and the songs which sort of defined the sound of the band. By the time we were about 18, 19, we'd sort of got the hang of it and stopped doing all the stuff. And it's really weird how gradually that happens, because when we were listening to some old albums recently, we realized that you do a lot of rubbish at the same time as you're doing the stuff that's going to end up being the stuff that you're proud of. So we kind of muddled around like that for a few years, and then Johnny joined the band when Franek was at Cardiff Art College, and then we moved to London, and then we eventually got signed to Moshi. So we'd sort of been the Wave Pictures for about 5 years already, even when we got signed and started doing more gigs and whatnot. So it's a long history.
But you do have a pretty dedicated following, don't you? And an extensive back catalogue of work. I mean, the next three nights you're playing three completely different sets.
Yeah,
is that right?
That's right, yeah.
I mean, how has your fan base kind of developed? Because you've played in lots of different countries as well, haven't you? I mean,
how's it developed? I don't know exactly how it's developed. It gets larger at a rate of about 5 people a year internationally. So by the time we're old, we'll have a really decent live following.
We might be able to make a living.
We might even be able to live. Yeah, just before we die, we'll be making a living. So it's sort of slowly but surely increasing. And generally speaking, everyone seems fairly nice who comes to Wave Pictures shows. You do get nutters, you know, but most people seem fairly nice, and you know,
for a broad
age range. It doesn't seem to alienate anybody too much or anything, which is good.
Have you got any nutters? Any really weird?
Oh, all the time. Yeah, there's just.
What's the weirdest thing that one of your fans has? Or
well, somebody nicked my shirt and then kept it for 2 years and then returned it by throwing it on stage with a note in the pocket saying, just sorry, just one word, sorry. And I've got no idea what they did with my shirt. I was quite pleased to get it back, but I thought that was weird. Because nick it and keep it, fine. But nick it and then return it, that's weird.
Yeah.
What are they hoping? And it had a little, email address, like I'd contact them and we'd become friends or something. Very, I think that's weird.
Were you wearing the shirt at the time when they stole it?
No.
How was it removed?
No, they didn't steal it off my body, no.
Do you think they were living in shame for 2 years then, if they were thinking about giving it back for all that time?
I don't know what was going on in their, you know, heads, their crazy, mad heads.
One of the names that keeps popping up when I'm reading about you guys is Jonathan Richman. And I think you started off by playing covers of his songs. And I just wondered how much of an influence has he had on the way that you write, and who else have been kind of influential artists for all of you?
Well, Jonathan Richman has had almost no influence on the writing, but a massive influence on the way that we play and think about doing live shows and on the way that we wanted to sound. I mean, from when I first heard his records, it was really something new, which combined what I liked about rock and roll and the energy of it without any of the sort of ridiculous macho posturing. It seemed completely down to earth. And so for me, he was a huge influence. If I hadn't heard him, I would never have thought I could be in a rock band at all, I don't think, because it really seemed like you had to be just a ridiculous ass to be a rock musician. But in terms of the writing, I don't write my song, the lyrics are nothing like his lyrics, his lyrics are generally crystal clear and very literal and naive and childlike. And my lyrics are much more wordy and very different.
More mature.
Well, I don't know about more mature, but less simple. Just you know, for better or worse. Other influences on us, I guess, Herman June, Bob Dylan, Neil Young is one we talk about all the time. Television, Rolling Stones.
Based records, compilations.
What about you? You're sitting very quietly there. Trying to be diplomatic.
Yeah, I'm leaving them to it, aren't I? The records that I listened to for drums, I suppose, were like Hefner records, which isn't maybe a lot of drummers' choice of influence, but just keeping it very simple and trying to have the right spirit and the right kind of energy. The Violent Femmes as well, just trying to do some good rocking drumming without too much complexity in it.
And what can people expect from your new album?
Well, it's a little bit punchier, is what I've been told by friends, than our previous albums. Johnny Helms' drumming is, when he was talking before about good, simplistic rock and roll drumming, he's nailed it on this new album, ladies and gentlemen.
He also sings on this one.
Yes.
Which is a real Johnny Helm album.
Yeah, it's a good album for Johnny Helm. Johnny Helm fans are going to love this album.
Big moment for you, Johnny.
I'm really excited about it. I hope everyone likes it as much as I do.
That was Katie talking to Johnny, Frannick and Dave, and they are the Wave Pitchers, from whom we'll hear one last track at the end of the show. What show? Culture, with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24, of course. Next up, Dallas Art.
For the latest Monocle news, previews on upcoming films, glimpses of the new issue, and the inside scoop of all of our retail ventures and new products, you need to do one simple thing. Subscribe to the free Monocle Bulletin. Sign up now at monocle.com.
Now it's time to enjoy an opening night. We recently dispatched Monocle's New York editor Aisha Spears to Dallas Art, and she sent this report from the Erik Svensson opening at the Nasher Sculpture Museum.
My name is Jed Morris. I'm chief curator at the Nasher Sculpture Center.
And what opening are we at this evening?
We're at the opening of the Sightings Erik Svensson exhibition.
And Erik Svensson, tell us a little bit about Erik. He's a local... He's a Texan?
He is by now, yeah. Okay. No, Erik is originally from all over the place. His father was in the Army, so he traveled quite a bit, but eventually settled in North Texas and went to school at the University of North Texas in Denton. So he's been in the area for about 15 years now. But he is a widely recognized artist nationally and internationally as well, represented in major collections around the world, including the Saatchi Collection in London. But he does still call Dallas his home, and so we claim him as ours.
And this evening, it seems quite a spectacle. It's taking place in the same week as Dallas Art Fair. There seem to be a number of openings this week. Yeah. Is that something which you guys intended to do? It was a good time to get people in. And what are people going to see? What does this exhibition show us?
The fact that the opening coincides with the Dallas Art Fair is intentional. It's a good time to present a new exhibition. There are a number of people from gallerists and dealers to collectors who descend upon Dallas for the Dallas Art Fair. And so it offers an opportunity to bring them into the Sculpture Center, have them understand a bit better what we do, and also highlight artists that we think are of significance. So in this exhibition, the Siding Series is actually an ongoing series of commissioned installations where we invite an artist to make new work for presentation at the Nasher Sculpture Center. And sometimes in dialogue with Renzo Piano's building, and other times not necessarily. Mm-hmm. So in this case, we approached Eric quite some time ago, knowing that his work involved a very painstaking and lengthy process of production. And just because the Sightings series focuses on new work, knowing that he would need a lot of time. Mm-hmm. And the result of that time is fairly extraordinary. If you walk into the exhibition, there are three major works, and they deal with the themes that he has engaged in for much of his career. They are these hyper-realist sculptures of animals in various kinds of distressing situations. There's one work that was finished in 2010 and really is kind of the postlude to a whole series of works that he's done featuring deer.
Okay.
And this work called Ne Plus Ultra is this incredibly realistic sculpture of a decomposing deer carcass that is laid out on the floor of the gallery. When the viewer first comes upon it, it's rather shocking. It's obviously distressing and grotesque. But the closer they get, you start to realize that there is this beautiful scrimshaw on the bones. The bones are etched with these incredibly delicate ancient seafaring maps. And, of course, the title Ne Plus Ultra refers to notations on those maps to indicate areas that hadn't been explored yet. It means nothing beyond this. And, of course, that can be taken existentially as well with the subject matter.
And is Eric particularly popular in Dallas for being an artist who's chosen to make this his home?
Yeah, Eric has lots of friends and admirers in Dallas, and he's been here for quite some time. First came to the attention of people in Dallas as part of an art collective called the Good Bad Art Collective that was based in Denton and was composed primarily of students from the University of North Texas that were doing really amazing and progressive kind of temporary installations. And this is in the late 90s. And it was really a landmark exhibition in 1998, his first solo exhibition in the area at the Angstrom Gallery called Obviously a Movie, that so impressed so many people in Dallas and really marked him as an artist to watch. And then after that, he received the attention of curators at the Whitney, was involved, included in the Whitney Biennial in 2004, the interest in his work has spread from there.
And that was Monocle's New York editor taking a trip west to check out the Nasher Sculpture Museum in Dallas. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Thank you for doing so. Time for our 1 minute of sound, and today it comes from Paris. You know the form. This week, Alexander Ohn sent us some noise. That was 1 minute of sound from Paris. So that's just about all we have time for this week. Next week, we'll be investigating collectors and collections in all forms. Put it in your diary, subscribe to the podcast, enjoy it until your hard drive melts. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producers were Katie Bilboa and Holly Fisher. Time for one final song this week. It's the latest single from the Wave Pictures' new album, Long Black Cars. The single, Spaghetti, is out next week on Moshi Moshi Records, and they performed it for us here at Midori House. That was Culture. Thanks for tuning in.
I kiss and you doggy paddle, and together we made one whole swimming machine. Later on, with salt on our skins, we shared a tin of kidney. Sticking, clicking in my throat. We throw our bodies over the side of the boat. You must know I'm stuck on you. Stuck as if with airplane blue. Wild hair tumbling from the center.
Thank you very much.